This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.
Reverend Johnson has done quite a good job of laying the theological and biblical groundwork for some of the specific issues that we need to consider as Christians tonight, issues of life and death. Issues of life and death, not simply because they touch upon the questions of life and death themselves, but life and death issues because of their importance as well. That is, life and death challenges to the Church of Jesus Christ because of what is going on in our society and the scientific world today, and our need to offer some kind of reforming guidance to our society in these matters that are not only so important that we call them life and death issues, but it so happens they center on matters of life and death as well. I'm going to be taking the question of the beginning of life for our subject matter in this next session. Following that, Reverend Johnson will return and speak to us about the living of life, specific issues about how we behave and how we conduct ourselves during life. And then I'll return for our last session to talk about the termination or end of life and some moral questions that are being posed in that area today as well. But for right now, let's look at the beginning of life and the proper place to begin. Discussion of the beginning of life is right at the beginning of the Bible in Genesis, the first chapter, verse 28, where we'll see a divine mandate for childbearing itself. Genesis 1, verse 28. And God blessed them, and God said unto them, be fruitful and multiply, and replenish the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. God gives a twofold command here to man. The first thing he tells man is to be fruitful and multiply. God requires man to be fruitful. God expects that man is going to multiply, that he's going to extend the human race, and that by the means of childbearing. God lays that down as a requirement that man has children. Be fruitful and multiply. And through this avenue of being fruitful and multiplying, man is then going to be able to replenish the earth and subdue it. He's going to have the ability to exercise dominion under God over the lower creation. Be fruitful and multiply, and as families, subdue and have dominion over the earth. And as has been told you already in Genesis, the 9th chapter, this commandment is repeated by God, Genesis 9, verse 1, and God blessed Noah and his sons and said unto them, be fruitful and multiply. Be fruitful and multiply. Verse 7, and you, be ye fruitful and multiply, bring forth abundantly in the earth and multiply therein. And so line upon line lays it down that man's primary task, if he's going to exercise dominion under God, is to be fruitful, to bear children, to multiply, fill the earth, replenish the earth with people. This is a principle that applies to man in all ages. This wasn't simply a task that God gave to man at the very beginning, or if you will, before man fell into sin, or while man was still in his pristine purity, ethically speaking. No, God gave this commandment to man qua man. He gave it to man as man, whether this be sinful man or unfallen man. Adam as he was created or Adam as he fell, whether it was given to Adam or to Noah. All men in all ages live under the requirement of God to be fruitful and to multiply. And God speaks of the blessing of fertility in the scriptures as well. You'll turn in your Bibles to Leviticus 26, verse 9, to find an example of that. Leviticus 26, 9, and I will have respect unto you, that is to say, if you have respect unto my commandments, God says, I will have respect unto you, and make you fruitful, and multiply you, and will establish my covenant with you. The God who says you are to be fruitful, you are to multiply, now says, if you have respect for all of my commandments, if you live under my dominion, if you live under my covenant requirements, I will cause you to be fruitful. I will make you fertile. I will see to it that you have children. I will give you the enabling power to fulfill that commandment, that lies upon man as man, to be fruitful and multiply. And a well-known passage from the Psalms, Psalm 128, verses 3 and 4, also speak of the blessing of fertility, something that God grants as well as something that God requires. Psalm 128, verses 3 and 4. Thy wife shall be as a fruitful vine in the innermost parts of thy house, thy children like olive plants round about thy table. Behold, thus shall the man be blessed that feareth the Lord. This is the way God will bless man who fears him. Specifically, God will show his love for those who keep his covenant by making their wives fruitful, enabling them to multiply so that that man might have children planted about his house. There's a blessing, you see, in childbearing. God requires it, and God grants it. We must conclude, therefore, that artificial insemination, in vitro fertilization, genetic engineering, cloning, what have you, are all ethical questions that we have to face as Christians, but they are ethical questions pertaining to the proper means of fulfilling the mandate God has given for having children. There should be no question in our mind but that God wants us to have children. There is a mandate, there is a blessing in having children. And so the only question is, what is the proper means toward bringing children into this world? Now, I've just said there is no question but that that is a proper goal. The only thing we have to ask ourselves is, what steps should we take to achieve that goal? But there are those about us today who would say, oh no, you can't take that for granted. You must not take it for granted that we're under obligation to bear children and that God wants that, and that's a proper ideal after which to strive. You can't take that for granted, because after all, when God gave these commandments, he gave them so many long years, ages ago, when the earth knew very, very few people. After all, the first time God said to be fruitful and multiply, he said it when there were only two people on the face of the earth. The next time that he said it, there was only one family on the face of the earth. And the blessings that he promises to his children, the Israelites, about fertility, and we read of in the Psalms, are still in an age of the earth when it was hardly populated at all. But now look around us. Now you see the crowding of our cities. Now you see the alleged threat of overpopulation. Now, living in this modern day, we cannot take it for granted that God has given us a mandate for childbearing. We cannot take it for granted. It is not to be assumed that we are to be doing everything we can to pursue bringing children into the world, because we are being threatened with overpopulation. And I want to make three remarks very quickly in response to this alleged threat of overpopulation, the first of which is most relevant factually, and that's simply that. The threat of overpopulation, if ever there was a threat of overpopulation, is certainly not statistically the case today. We continue to hear the rhetoric of overpopulation. We continue to hear the government programs that are designed to meet that need and which are justified in light of the alleged need that overpopulation poses, or the threat that it poses. But the fact of the matter is, statistically, is that in Japan, Germany, Switzerland, France, and in most areas of our own country, although not all, in most of these areas, in fact, in almost every major industrial country in the world, there is no longer a threat of overpopulation, but just the opposite threat, the threat of population stagnation and decline. The zero population growth mentality and the idea that we must actually cut back on the number of people that are putting a burden upon the earth's supply of food has been effective in most of the industrial countries of our world in bringing about the widespread use of birth control, in many cases the acceptance and proliferation of abortion, and consequently we have aging populations. We don't have populations that, if you will, are being dominated by youth, but now ages that are coming to be dominated by aging people. We are populations that are displaying labor shortages. There are not enough young people coming into the labor pool to take care of the various jobs that are being left by those who are retiring or who are dying. The fact of the matter is that overpopulation is not a threat in these countries, but it is, in fact, the threat of stagnation. In fact, UN economists, and I suppose by citing a UN economist, nobody will accuse me of being biased in that evidence that I go to. After all, if a UN economist will say this, then I think you can take it for granted. UN economist Colin Clark has written just recently that if the Western industrialized nations continue to promote negative population growth, a worse population problem will occur in those countries than that population problem that was caused by the medieval Black Death. Overpopulation is not a problem today. Overpopulation is a popular rhetorical device to justify government programs that interfere even further in our lives and control the kind of economy that we are allowed to have. But totally apart from the facts and the motivations of the overpopulation rhetoric, the fact remains for us as Christians that God promises in His Word blessing upon His people when they bear children. God promises provision when His people will bear children. In fact, in the 28th chapter of Deuteronomy, verses 2 through 6, God says that a culture that will keep His commandments, a culture that will honor His moral standards, will be a culture that is blessed with fruitfulness. Fruitfulness in the family, fruitfulness in the flock, fruitfulness in one's crop. God will bless a civilization that is founded upon His Word. God will not only bless that civilization with fertility so they have children, but God will make now adequate provision. There will be blessing among the animals and the crops so that there is provision for food to eat for these children that are being born as well. And now some people will, of course, say that was a specialized kind of promise that was given in the Old Testament only for the Jews, and I will not discourse on whether that is the way we should interpret that passage or not. Suffice it to say, however, that Jesus says, and certainly the epitome of Christian moral preaching found in the New Testament, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus promises His followers that if they will seek first the kingdom of God and its righteousness, what will be added to them? All of these things, all of the things after which we strive, all of the things that worry us, the things such as clothing and food and all the rest. And Jesus, of course, bids us to consider the lilies of the field. If God so clothes all of those things out there that are less than His image, how much more will God take care of His people when they are pursuing His kingdom and its righteousness? I see that as formally parallel to the promise of the Old Testament. God says, if you will seek My righteousness, My kingdom and its ends, I will make adequate provision for your lives. The threat of overpopulation, if it is a threat, is a consideration that flies directly in the face of the promises of God, and as such, as Christians, we must dismiss it. Overpopulation may be a threat among the ungodly. They have no promises of provision, but it is not a threat among the godly. God will see to it that His people have their daily needs. And so we will proceed then in our discussion of the beginning of life tonight on the assumption that there is a divine mandate for childbearing, and we should be pursuing ways of bringing children into the world and aiding people in doing so. The last consideration by way of introduction before we actually look at artificial insemination and genetic engineering is the consideration that the home, the family, is central in this matter of bearing children. Back in Genesis, the first chapter again, verse 26, I think it's significant that we take note how God says, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and the birds of the heavens," and so forth. Let us make man in our image, and let them have dominion. Let them have dominion. Who is the them that is going to have dominion here? Obviously, it's Adam and his wife Eve, not simply the man. You see, it's not simply a male-dominated world in the sense that men make all the decisions and anything that's important has to do with the vocation of man. But the vocation of the woman is called into play here too. They will have dominion together as a family, as husband and wife. They are going to exercise dominion. In verse 27 of the same chapter, God created man in His own image, and the image of God created He him. Male and female created He them. Now, whether that male and female combination has anything to do with the image of God, or whether it's integral to the image of God, or part of the defining essence of the image of God, I will not try to give any answer to those questions tonight. But this much can be said, that when God made man in his own image to exercise dominion, the next thing that we are told in the Bible, and something which is certainly a related truth of great importance, is that man was made as male and female. Husband and wife exercise dominion over creation. In Genesis, the second chapter, verses 18 to 24, a passage that you'll know very well, I'm sure, we read of the loneliness of man and of his inability to pursue his task by himself. There's something greatly inappropriate about Adam being by himself in the garden and trying to do this task that God has given him. After all, if man is supposed to be fruitful and multiply, how is Adam to do that on his own? And so Eve is created, you'll notice, not simply that Adam can now be fruitful and multiply and bring children into the world, but Eve is created and specifically called a help meet, a helper appropriate to her husband. And so you see, over and over and over again in the early chapters of the Bible, how the family is central in this task of bringing children into the world for the sake of exercising godly dominion over creation. And so immediately, we can ask ourselves the question whether childbearing in the 20th century ought to be removed from the context of family affection, ought to be removed from the context of male-female relations, husband and wife relations, ought to be removed from the context of the family and the interrelation of those who love each other as a family unit, ought the bringing of children into the world be removed from that context into the cold sterility, and I choose that word very cautiously, should it be removed from the affection of the family into the sterility of the laboratory? That's a question that we need to ask ourselves as we now look at the issue of artificial insemination and genetic engineering. Artificial insemination is not really a modern device, although its procedures have been perfected in our own day. In the late 1790s, a medical doctor in England was able to inseminate the wife of a tailor. There, in the 1860s in our own country, a woman was inseminated with the aid of a doctor using her husband's own sperm. And at the turn of the century, there was a great deal of medical attention given to this question of artificial insemination, and it has developed throughout the 20th century until today. The procedure is fairly well advanced toward its perfection and is used very often. The history of opinion on it is very interesting to me. The Roman Catholic Church, in a sense, sees artificial insemination as a moral issue that is the flip side of the contraceptive issue. For in Roman Catholic theological opinion, there should be no sex without the intent of childbearing. Sex and childbearing go together, something like horse and carriage. They belong together. And whenever you take an interest in one without the other, you've got somehow the natural order perverted. And so sex should be for the purpose of childbearing. Consequently, no contraceptives. And vice versa as well. There shouldn't be any childbearing without sex. No sex without childbearing, no childbearing without sex. And consequently, the Roman Catholic Church has condemned artificial insemination and has only recently, in a very, very narrow set of cases, allowed for any qualification on that condemnation. Well, of course, that was the Roman Catholic Church, and we as Protestants would hardly expect better of them. But the sad fact is that the Protestant Church has done hardly any better at all. Already in 1957, G. Aiken Taylor, currently the editor of the Presbyterian Journal that many of us read, the editor of that journal wrote an article for Christianity Today on artificial insemination, condemning it from the Protestant perspective as a form of adultery, calling it adultery. And so the history of opinion sees fairly universal condemnation in the Christian church up until the early 1960s, and then there's been a great swing of opinion the other direction in the most recent years. As we look at artificial insemination in biblical perspective, I think a good place to begin our consideration is with the curse of barrenness that the Bible lays out for us. Perhaps the best example that we can find in the Old Testament displaying for us this cursed condition, barrenness, is that of Hannah, as we read of it in 1 Samuel, the first chapter. 1 Samuel chapter 1, verses 5 to 10, we read that Elkanah, Hannah's husband, gave unto her a double portion. He gave her a double portion over against the single portion that he gave his other wife. Elkanah had two wives. He gave to Hannah a double portion, for he loved Hannah, but Jehovah had shut up her womb. And her rival, that is to say, Elkanah's other wife, and her rival provoked her sore to make her fret because Jehovah had shut up her womb. And as he did so year by year, her husband going up to Jerusalem, when she went up to the house of Jehovah, so she, that is the other wife, provoked her again. Therefore she wept and she did not eat. And Elkanah, her husband, said unto her, Hannah, why do you weep? And why don't you eat? And why is your heart grieved? Am I not better to you than 10 sons? Elkanah shows just an amazing sympathy for his wife here, really understanding what she's going through. And he says to Hannah, look, you may not have any children, but you've got me, and I'm better than 10 sons, aren't I? Verse 9, so Hannah rose up after they had eaten in Shiloh and after they had drunk. In verse 10, and she was in bitterness of soul and prayed unto Jehovah and wept sore. That was very little healing to her soul, what her husband said. Barrenness was a great curse. Here God has commanded families to have children. God has promised the blessing of having children. And Hannah has her womb shut up. And she is in bitterness of her tears. You see, this is working great psychological damage to her. She can hardly bear the situation that she cannot bear children. And so in Psalm 113, we see something of the counterpart to the curse of barrenness in the promise of God. If you want to see what a blessed God we have, if you want to see how God takes the poor and lifts them up and sets them on high, if you want to see how God reverses, if you will, the situations of people in the world, how he takes the first and makes them last, and takes the last and makes them first. Psalm 113 gives us some examples of that. Verse 7 says, he raises the poor out of the dust and lifts them up out of the dunghill. You find the poorest man in your culture, the man that shoved down right into the dunghill, and God will make something of that man. He reverses, you see, the conditions of men in this world. And then the next illustration is fascinating. Verse 9, he makes the barren woman to keep house and to be a joyful mother of children. Praise ye, Jehovah. That's the kind of God we have, the God who takes barren women and makes them to have children, to be joyful mothers. God is interested in having women bear children. God puts his, if you will, stamp of approval upon the task of enabling barren women to have children. God will see to it that the barren become joyful mothers. And so one of the first and obvious reasons for artificial insemination is because of barrenness, the inability of a couple to have their own child. Now that barrenness can pertain to the womb of the woman, of course, the wife, or it can pertain to the impotence and or sterility of the male himself. But there are other reasons for artificial insemination that can be posed as well. One very obvious one is the threat of genetic defects that may be passed on from a couple where doctors are very aware of the likelihood of that taking place if they have their own natural biological children, in which case they may want to go the route of genetic engineering, artificial insemination in this case. Another reason that has been proposed, although I don't personally approve of it, but one that you might want to know of, is when a soldier goes away for a period of time from his wife, or there's going to be a separation of the husband and wife for some other legitimate reason, it may be then a man would like to leave behind the ability for his wife to be impregnated in case he should not come back or should not come back for a long period of time. There are two basic forms of artificial insemination that we need to consider tonight, both abbreviated AI and then H for artificial insemination husband, where the sperm is provided by the woman's husband, and then artificial insemination D or donor, AID, artificial insemination donor, when an anonymous party, an anonymous male, contributes sperm with which the wife is impregnated, inseminated. There are some obvious objections that people have thought of right off the top of their heads, it seems to me, various objections that we consider that I deem to be very poor objections against artificial insemination. The first is the one based upon Roman Catholic theological patterns of thought that says that this is against nature, against nature. There's something of a fallacy of reification found in this thinking. The fallacy of reification in philosophy pertains to taking something and turning it into a substance, making it into a concrete entity, when in fact it's nothing more than a generalization. And that word nature is precisely a generalization that is easily reified by many people. In fact, it can be so definitely reified that we can see Mother Nature on television commercials these days. But there is no such thing as nature, and to speak of somebody violating the laws of nature calls for some explication. Roman Catholics see those procedures which are contrary to nature as in many cases being procedures or activities that are contrary to the statistical average, if you will, the statistical average in the way things normally operate. So if most people bring children into this world by a natural act of copulation, then it is against nature. It's against, if you will, the run of the mill. It's against the middle of the stream. It's against the statistical norm for how children are normally brought into this world. That isn't the way it is naturally done, and therefore it is wrong. And the naturalistic fallacy is a very obvious fallacy, it seems to me, in this line of thinking. The naturalistic fallacy says that we can reason from the nature of things, the way they actually are, to the way things ought to be. We can move from nature to morality, if you will, from is to ought. We can say, since this is the way things are, this is the way things should be. The Roman Catholic makes that mistake by reasoning that since children normally are brought into the world through natural copulation, that's the way they should be brought into the world and the only way they should be brought into the world. The fact of the matter is that we violate nature all the time, and we not only do so with impunity, we actually think that we're guilty if we don't violate nature. After all, we remove weeds from our flower beds, don't we? Nature would be very displeased if there were such a person as nature. We cut cancers out of people. We attempt to cure polio. We homogenize our milk. And of all things, we fly through the air. All of these things are contrary to the natural course of things, and yet we wouldn't find them morally objectionable. And so we need to move on from the Roman Catholic objection that this is against nature to the more sophisticated objection that artificial insemination is actually amounting to adultery. Now, a very contrived definition of adultery is necessary to make this argument work. The definition of adultery that is used by people who argue in this way is adultery is the surrender of one's reproductive facilities to another person to whom they're not married. The surrender of one's reproductive facilities to somebody that's not your mate. Is that what you normally think of when you read in the seventh commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not surrender your reproductive facilities to another? Obviously, a woman who undergoes a hysterectomy has surrendered her reproductive facilities to another, but we wouldn't accuse her of committing adultery with the doctor who performs the operation. That is not what the Bible looks upon as adultery. You see, artificial insemination doesn't amount to adultery because there's no act of copulation involved. It's a simple medical procedure. Not only is there no act of copulation, there's no broken faith between husband and wife, except in those cases where a wife does it without her husband's consent or knowledge. But we're not talking about that here. We're talking about a husband and wife both want to pursue this as a way of gaining children. There's no broken faith in terms of their sexual fidelity. Moreover, as Jesus points out in the fifth chapter of Matthew, the Sermon on the Mount again, the very heart of adultery, the core of that sin, pertains to lust, has to do with lust. And since there is no lust involved in artificial insemination, it is certainly contrived to argue that it amounts to adultery. There's no copulation, no broken faith, no lust. Well, then another argument that at least begins to sound like something that might make us hesitate about artificial insemination is the observation that before the process of artificial insemination can be carried out, there needs to be an act of masturbation by which the sperm is secured that is inseminated into the woman. And I will not dwell long on this consideration of masturbation. Masturbation certainly is a sin, I believe, although I don't think there's a lot of literature on the subject that argues that fact convincingly today. But the fact is that a case can be made against masturbation, and a good one can be made against masturbation. But what needs to be said in terms of artificial insemination is that it does not call for an act of masturbation. It may be the most common way that doctors collect sperm, the easiest, if you will, least complication. But the fact is that inseminating sperm can also be collected after a natural marital act in cases where the husband is not impotent or sterile. It can sometimes be collected from the husband himself. It can be collected by a doctor through aspiration. It can be collected by a doctor through the massage of a prostate gland. So there are any number of ways of securing fertile sperm totally apart from an act of masturbation. Others have argued against artificial insemination, saying, well, adoption should be enough. I mean, why should a woman have to bear her own child biologically if she can just go out and adopt the child? In response to that, we need to point out, just as a statistical and sad fact, that adoptions are not readily available to people these days. It's very difficult to find a child to adopt. Extremely difficult. The statistics are very low, primarily due to the abortion epidemic in our country and the use of birth control. There are not that many children to adopt. So even if a couple would have been satisfied with adoption, it may not be available to them. But even where an adoption is available to a couple, it is not always the case that that is the emotionally satisfying thing that the woman needs. Now, you may argue, well, she should be satisfied with that, just like, I guess, Elkanah thought that Hannah should have been satisfied with him or something. But the fact is that some women bear within themselves that psychological drive, that desire to have their own child. And they are able to do so if they can only gain the medical technology that will overcome this or that obstacle. Finally, there are some circumstantial, psychological, or social dangers that are often cited against artificial insemination. There's the possibility of sentiment reversal in the husband. Here he gives permission for his wife to be artificially inseminated, but then that child becomes to him, you see, the constant symbol of his own impotence or his own sterility, and therefore there's a sentiment reversal so that he comes to hate the child even though he once desired the child. Some doctors have written of the uneasiness some donors have when a man donates his sperm for the use of inseminating a woman who couldn't ordinarily get pregnant. He sometimes is uneasy that he may be running into his own children on the street and not know that. There's the possibility of unwitting incest, that one man's sperm may be used to inseminate this woman and that woman, and that these two women have children that grow up and get married. The threat of a sex ratio being affected. Since in artificial insemination, the tendency is for the sperm that lives through the procedure to be male sperm, the threat is that we're going to get an unbalanced population with more boys than girls growing up. There's the possibility of unmarried mothers, and we wouldn't approve of that, some would say. There's also the threat of a scheming woman who goes to a doctor to be inseminated and then holds that over the head of somebody, another man, saying, you then owe paternal support, or you must marry me, or something like that. The possibility of the exploitation by doctors, legal questions about paternal support. All of these things have been raised at one time or another as cautions against artificial insemination and have been urged against it as an abuse that is possible if we make use of the procedure. However, it's a cardinal rule of ethics that abuse does not rule out proper use. The fact that the United States government is often abused and people make use of their office for their own private gain, and as we've seen in this week, and even be thrown out of office because of that, does not mean that we're ready to throw away human government. The fact that food can be used in an improper way and overused, if you will, so that we can become fat, doesn't lead us to throw away food. And the fact that artificial insemination as a procedure may be abused, the fact that there may be cautions or limits or restrictions that we'd want to put upon it to make sure that some of these abuses don't commonly follow, does not lead us properly to the conclusion that artificial insemination is wrong in itself. I'd like to offer very briefly a case in favor of artificial insemination for us as Christians. The first thing that I need to say, of course, is that the proper conditions will have to be met before we'll be satisfied with artificial insemination as a procedure. Those conditions, as I see it, are at least three in number, and if time permitted, we could probably elaborate further. But first of all, we're talking about artificial insemination tonight within the context of monogamous marriage. Within the context of monogamous marriage, and we can actually go further and say a strong marriage, not one that's threatened by dissolution, marriage between Christian husband and Christian wife, where they are firmly committed to each other, faithful, and all the rest. Secondly, as a proper condition, artificial insemination would have to be pursued with the knowledgeable consent of both the husband and the wife that are going to raise the child. The knowledgeable consent of both. And thirdly, we may want to add that artificial insemination should only be pursued with a responsible doctor, where it's known that healthy men are supplying the sperm, and those who are supplying the sperm are doing so not through acts of masturbation, and they are doing so with the understanding that the doctor will only use that in couples that are happily married, firmly committed to each other, Christians who are going to love the child and bring it up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. So we can add all these qualifications to make sure that the abuses, as much as is humanly possible, can be eliminated. Now, under those conditions, within that context, it seems to me that the question of artificial insemination donor is answered, at least to some degree, by the procedure recorded for us in Deuteronomy, the 25th chapter, verses 5 and 6. In Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 and 6, we read of the levirate institution in the Old Testament. And I, by no means, am advocating the continuing validity and use of the levirate institution today. I do believe that it was definitely designed for the local conditions of the people in the promised land and under the conditions of their promise to secure the land and keep it within the family. But the fact remains that we can learn something about the principles of morality by looking at this legislation, even though we don't follow it out explicitly today. If brothers dwell together and one of them die and have no son, and the wife of the dead shall not be married, the wife of the dead shall not be married without unto a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in unto her and take her to him to wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother unto her. And it shall be that the firstborn that she beareth shall succeed in the name of his brother that is dead, that his name be blotted not out of Israel. The levirate institution provided that when two brothers were living together and one had a wife, the brother who has a wife, should he die, can count on the fact that the other brother is going to raise up children through his widow. And interestingly, the Bible makes very explicit here that although the sperm, if you will, is donated by the other brother, the living brother, to whom she is not officially married, nevertheless, the child is designated as the child of the dead husband. Okay, now the principle I'm pointing to here is the principle that God does not universally forbid the donation of sperm. Even when it's not going to be a husband-wife relationship that's continuing, and when the child that grows up as a result of the use of that sperm and its inseminating powers is not going to belong to the one who donates the sperm. Consequently, we have something of an analogy, not a perfect one, but something of an analogy to artificial insemination here. But I'd like to make the case stronger by referring, thirdly, to the possibility of seeing in artificial insemination an extension of adoption into the biological sphere. In a sense, you might look upon artificial insemination simply as a very early adoption. Those of us who have adopted children, my wife and I have done that. We adopted a girl at 5 years old, and we knew the pros and cons of doing that. Some people would say it's much better to adopt a child before the child's 3 years old. Others would say, by all means, if you can, adopt the child within the first year of its life. And if you can possibly get the child as a newborn baby, only a couple days, you see, that would be even better. And what I'm saying is, if we see the advantage of adopting children, and we see it's legitimate, why would it not be possible for a wife, if you will, pardon the analogy, to adopt, if you will, the sperm that's made available by an anonymous donor so that she might biologically become the mother of this child that is legally adopted by her husband? And so there's an extension of adoption. Obviously, there's a disanalogy here, too. Usually, adopted children are those that have been orphaned because of the death of their parents or abandoned. And so somebody might argue, but you certainly don't want to argue that men should abandon their sperm, do you? Well, of course, I'm not arguing that men should abandon their sperm. I'm arguing that they ought to contribute it to responsible doctors so that they can be used to overcome the medical handicap of Christian couples that can then legitimately bear children and bring them up to the glory of God. I really believe that all the arguments that can be urged against artificial insemination will turn out to apply against adoption as well. The arguments that are usually urged against artificial insemination turn out to be arguments against adoption also. And consequently, this extension of adoption into the biological sphere, or the analogy of adoption, for me anyway, clinches the case for artificial insemination as a legitimate procedure under proper conditions. But now, artificial insemination was really nothing more but the camel's nose under the tent, because what we're seeing taking place today is not simply such a simple procedure as artificial insemination, but the whole realm of genetic engineering. There are great, amazing prospects in the realm of science that pose themselves to us, present themselves to us for use today. In fact, the public attitude has changed so much that we can almost see a shift from fatalism with respect to childbirth. There's nothing you can do about it. You either do or you don't have children. There's nothing you can do about the kind of child, the health of the child, the heredity of the child, and so forth. The public attitude has changed and swung almost from fatalism to an apprehensive attitude that maybe we might be doing just too much. The fear is we've gone too far, because medical intervention can now repair more and more defects in the births of children, more and more the hereditary problems that have afflicted children can be dealt with by medical science. We are moving, some people think, so far into the realm of manipulating the birth process that we're no longer exercising cooperative control as human beings over the lower creation. It's come to the point where one set of human beings is manipulating another set of human beings. The possibility of artificial embryonation has presented itself in our day, where an embryo from one woman can now be taken and put in another woman. In vitro fertilization, where the embryo from one woman and the sperm from a man can be brought together in a glass dish, and that fertilized egg, that fetus, can now then be put back into either the donating woman or another woman altogether. Test tube babies, the possibility of creating artificial wombs where a child can be developed through the gestation period all the way up to birth in the laboratory presents itself. Now, we're far from doing any of these things, actually producing them, but an in vitro fertilization has taken place already in England, and we have teams of doctors that are working on that possibility in East Virginia right now in our own country. What modern medical science is presenting to us today is the possibility of genetics by choice, then, the possibility of eliminating defects in our children through the use of sperm banks, through cloning procedures where we can produce identical twins by a nuclear transplantation. Although that's not technically feasible as human beings, we've already engaged as scientists in the cloning of frogs and other lower life forms, and so that seems to be coming for human beings as well. The whole area of eugenics, the improvement of the hereditary endowment of the human race, area of eugenics fell into disrepute in the 1930s and 40s because of the racist overtones of Hitler's Germany and of the race tension felt between whites and blacks in our own country and around the world. But eugenics is being revived today, for instance, in the setting up of sperm bank and taking of embryos from women and thinking of the ideal combinations of these things, allowing then for a choice in the future anyway to couples as to the kind of germinal material that will go into their child. The question is this genetics by choice a perversion of science, a perversion of the cultural mandate, or is this an extension of science and the cultural mandate, God giving us the ability to overcome some of the effects of the curse of sin in the natural world? After all, we already make use of hereditary clinics, counseling couples that may have genetic defects passed on to their children. Is this not just another step beyond that, not only counseling them as to whether they should have children naturally themselves, but also whether they should not now make use of sperm banks, embryo banks, and the rest? I want to say two things in conclusion about genetic engineering. They go in opposite directions. Hopefully they'll balance each other out. The first is the great need for the church to avoid a reactionary spirit in the face of these modern possibilities. The church has a deplorably sad history throughout the development of modern science, of seeing every new major development in science that's going to, in some sense, change our patterns of living or what we can do in terms of our human bodies, whether we are going to fly with them or go in locomotives or what have you, even cut people open and put new parts of hearts in them and so forth. At every stage of medical development and scientific development, the church, it seems, has been right there saying, this is contrary to God's will. This is not what God would want us to do. This is somehow perverted. This is wrong. And usually the naturalistic arguments are given that nature doesn't operate this way, so God wouldn't have us operate this way. If God wanted us to fly, he'd give us wings. You know that whole syndrome of consideration. The church has a deplorable history of trying to prevent modern medical advance, showing a reactionary spirit. We must remember that our secular culture will not be stopped by our arbitrary scruples, just because it somehow is uncomfortable to us to think of people doing these things. Modern scientific development will not stop just because we have some kind of qualms about it. Only legislation is going to stop scientists from developing life in a test tube, apart from the fact that God may prevent them from doing it. It may be a natural impossibility. Or, if you will, we might stop scientists from doing it by moral urging, if we should have the grounds morally for urging them in that direction. They will continue to do this, and it seems to me as long as science is developing this way, Christians ought to exercise their responsible duties as the children of God, looking for the dominion of man over the lower creation in the realm of science, offering reconstructive guidance from the Bible, restrictions that will be placed upon scientists, and constructive appropriations of the advances in science for the sake of God's glory. But there are reasons for caution. Having said that, we ought to watch out for a reactionary spirit within us, that spirit that naturally rises up and says it's unknown, so we're afraid of it. But there are reasons for caution. We must ask ourselves whether in some cases of genetic engineering we're not experimenting with life itself and therefore engaging in murder. As has already been explained to you tonight in Genesis the 9th chapter, God prevents man or prohibits man from eating the blood of the flesh because the blood represents the life. And God is sovereign over life, not man. Man is not the sovereign over life. And we must be asking ourselves, in the case of genetic engineering, whether man is exercising sovereignty in an area that God has prevented him from entering. We must exercise cautious use of fertilized embryos, fetuses, if you will, because, especially if our polemic against abortion is biblically sound, as I believe it is, we must see what is taking place in the laboratory glass dish as the bringing about of a human life, and it cannot be wantonly thrown away or arbitrarily thrown away, or, if you will, just tampered with or played with or experimented with as though it were just another guinea pig of sorts. Moreover, Paul Ramsey properly warns us of our genetic duty, as he calls it, not to take risk with another person's life when serious defects may be reasonably anticipated. What if somebody were to say that it's altogether possible that these earliest children that we develop in a laboratory through in vitro fertilization and then an artificial womb are going to grow up to be, if you will, like the elephant man that is being publicized again today and should be grossly deformed in that way? Would it be fair to the individual that is being brought up that we were, if you will, experimenting in a laboratory and that just happened to be the consequences that he has to bear in his life for the sake of our own, you see, medical advances? Exercise our genetic duty not to take risks with another person's life. There are obvious social consequences to consider as well. We can ask ourselves, has God made us stewards of the human gene pool? Is that properly within the cultural mandate? I would say that it probably is within the cultural mandate. However, it must be exercised in a way that brings glory to God and under the strictures of his holy commandments. Childbirth ought not to be completely isolated from the family context that is laid down at the very beginning of the Bible for us. Finally, and with this I'll conclude this lecture, I think we need to ask ourselves, even if we could do all the things that modern medicine is promising that we will do in the future, even if we could do those things right now, it would be a legitimate social question for our society to pose for itself, are we wise enough Are we morally mature enough to remake the human race in the ways that genetic engineering holds out to us? That is there not something to the self-restraint that can be exercised individually and socially that recognizes that we are not in a position, in terms of our own wisdom and moral maturity, to use the technological progress God can put within our hands for the true advance of God's kingdom and His glory? It wouldn't seem to me, considering the state of the world tonight as a result of the 6 o'clock news, that we really are at a place where morally we can make use of our technological advances in a God-pleasing way. That is not an argument against genetic engineering. It's a caution against it in our own day. Well, I'll allow you to ask questions later on after we finish our series of lectures. I'm sure many things may have come to your mind, and Reverend Johnson would be glad to answer those questions that you have about his lectures as well. But at this point, we're going to take something of a break.
This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute. Duplication, sharing, and distribution is encouraged. For more information about the life and ministry of Dr. Greg L. Bonson, visit our website, bonsoninstitute.com, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.